Right. We're going to pick up this evening. If you have your notes, we're going to start in verse 3. And at the top of the page, I went ahead and put all this vocabulary as it's translated into these different translations, starting with the King James Version and then going all the way up through the New International Version. And you can see that the words sometimes are fairly consistent and sometimes they're not. The drunkenness is pretty consistent, whereas the banquetings, carousings, drinking parties, and drinking bouts, well, that's basically the same, but a little bit different. Anyway, you can look at all of them and think about them a little bit. We're just going to quickly review where we left off last week, which was with this idea of lasciviousness or lewdness or sensuality or debauchery, depending on which translation that we're using. And I think maybe the best way to summarize it is James chapter 1. That's right in the middle of the page where it says that lust, when it conceives, bears sin. And then sin, when it is full grown, brings death. Well, I think this word pretty well captures full grown sin. When the conscience is finally dulled and social pressures removed and sin's just completely allowed to become the master. It's interesting that when children are coming of age, they're usually really embarrassed. They're very embarrassed about their sinful weaknesses. They don't really want anybody to know about them. They try to hide them. And a lot of us, after we became Christians, we've restored that. And we are ashamed of sin. And we don't want anybody to know about it. But these are people who just don't care. They're blatant about it. They don't have any sense of remorse or sorrow. At the bottom of the page, God says, were they ashamed when they committed abomination? No, they were not at all ashamed, nor did they know how to blush. And I think that that's really the idea here. And as Trench pointed out, it's really unfortunate that this has really focused in the sexual realm. No question, it works in the sexual realm, but it covers all sin. And so in the sexual realm, the reason it's so such an important part of it is because you can't commit any sexual activity with anyone else without losing your sense of shame and letting them know that you're interested. And that's a big step. That's a big step in people's sinful activity. One thing to look to lust, it's another thing to carry that into action. And so lasciviousness is the point where we don't care who knows about it anymore. And so that's really the first word. And each one of us in one realm or another, we had this characteristic and we really didn't care. Then we also, just again, a quick review of lusts, which is on the top of page 2. And the root meaning of lust is the Greek word thumos, which means something that can swell. And so when you put a plant in the ground, it starts to swell and become bigger and bigger. Well, in the mind, there are certain emotions that swell up. Anger just fills the mind, just completely overwhelms it. Sexual lust, greed, fear, various forms of violence and anger, they just completely fill the mind. The difference is that this time we look for that. We're not trying to put it out of our mind. We are trying to develop it. In the sexual realm, this is the people who like to look at pornography. In the realm of anger, these are the people who nurse their anger and remind themselves of it every day and seek to figure out ways that they can bring retribution. And so these are things that Christians just really have to flee and avoid. We did some of these things before we became a Christian, but we need to put them behind us. All right, as I say, those were just two quick reviews. Anybody have any additional comments on that? We had to quickly wrap that up at the end of class, so I wanted to give everybody a chance to weigh in. Okay, well, as we move into the new material here, we have three synonyms that follow in quick succession: drunkenness, revelries, and drinking parties. Now, that's how the King James or the New King James translates it. Other translations have various modifications on that because these are broad words and they have a lot of different meanings. But when the three of them sit side by side by this, like this, then we need to realize something, that these terms have some common thread, and that common thread here is alcohol. And I've got a real long definition here. I'm not going to read much of it tonight, but I would highly recommend that you read this, because basically the problem we have, the word drunkenness is only used here in the New Testament. This word for drunkenness, I know that there's other words, but this word for drunkenness, only used here. Drinking parties, only used here in the New Testament. And revelries is only used three times in the New Testament. So there's a little bit of a question, because we don't have anything to compare. We don't have anything to look at to say, okay, what exactly does this mean? How is it used over here? How does Jesus use it? Or how did Paul use it? Well, they didn't use it. The reality is that there is a common word for drunkenness that is used. Let's go ahead and turn to page 3. And this is the common word for drunkenness. And it is a word that, how would I put it? It just contemplates the finished act. Doesn't talk about how we got there. This person is drunk. Now, how they got here, what steps led up to it, that's not even under consideration. In this particular word, the only thing is that they are intoxicated. They are drunk. And so, as you see, Romans 13, not in revelry. There's the other use of that word that we talked about, the middle word. And then drunkenness, which is, as I say, a different Greek word. Then in 1 Corinthians 5, the drunkard will not inherit, or excuse me, the drunkard is someone we should withdraw from. Drunkards will not inherit the kingdom of God. In 1 Corinthians 6, in Galatians 5, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, and then do not be drunk with wine. So we see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different uses of that word. So Peter doesn't even use it. It's already been clearly revealed. It's already been established. So Peter takes us back a step. It has a little bit different meaning. And so this paragraph right in the middle of page 3, The word here that is translated drunkenness is, as Trench pointed out, it's a step in advance of drunkenness, because it describes the steps leading up to it. Now, this is an action. Drunkenness is a state, which, again, it doesn't even contemplate how did we get here. But this word, it means to drink. To get drunk, to drink too much wine. It may never get there. There's a passage in 1 Kings where there's a king who's drinking himself drunk. Well, that's this word. That's the decision that we make. I'm going to go out, I'm going to get some alcohol, and I'm going to get drunk tonight. I'm going to drink and drink and drink until I finally reach that state. Well, the reaching of the state is just as evil as the state itself. And so this word is used for the extravagant indulgence in long drawn out drinking. And that's why people go to bars. That's why people purchase enough alcohol for a wedding reception or a funeral, so that anybody there who wants to can drink as much as they want and drink and drink and drink. And so this is a state in advance of drunkenness. So the scriptures don't just condemn drunkenness, they condemn the process that leads to drunkenness. And of course, then the question is, well, at what point in that process does this begin? And that's where I think the other two words will help us to understand that. So as I say, there's a general word for drunkenness that's used throughout the New Testament. Then there's this word that's only used here. And several of the lexicons point out that one is a passive state and the other is the action that leads to that passive state. So once I become drunk, then that is the passive state. But the steps leading up to drunkenness, the purchasing of the alcohol, the decision to go to a place where there'll be plenty of alcohol, the decision to drink to the point of excess so that you become drunk, this is what's involved in this word. So Peter just passes over the actual state. He wants, the Holy Spirit here wants us to understand that not only is the state evil, but the process that leads up to it is evil. Anybody have any questions or comments on that first term?
Well, I was just, this is Ken, I was just thinking that that seems to imply that there was a decision to go ahead and become subject to this problem. I mean, you know, there was an actual mental state saying, I'm going to go ahead and do this, and then I'll be passive, but that's a cop-out.
Well, yeah, it's the decision, I'm going to get drunk. Then it's the decision, I'm going to go to the store to buy the alcohol, or I'm going to go to the bar where there's access to the alcohol, or I'm going to go to a party where there's alcohol. So this takes us back a long way. It takes us back. It's kind of like Jesus saying, you know, it isn't just adultery. It's looking at a woman to lust. And here we've got Peter saying it isn't just the state of drunkenness, but it's the decision to enter into the process, the decision to go to a place or be involved with. So, good point, Ken. Anybody else? Okay, well, the next word is revelry. And as we noted earlier, that word is used in three other places in the New Testament. So we have a little bit of comparing that we can do. But it's interesting that the terms, and we'll get to this in just a moment, but the term revelry is always in the same sentence with drunkenness. And so it has some kind of a tie with it, even though the word itself really is a little bit ambiguous. Matter of fact, if you look at the definition, what you see is that it's a party that is designed to create it's designed to create a place where people can break loose. This is when we talk about worldly parties, and they'll have loud music, they'll have alcohol, they'll have dancing, they'll have activities that allow people to work themselves up to sinful activities. Now, whether that's going to be fighting or sexual activity, or whether it's going to be gambling or other activities, it just depends on the purpose of the party. But the result here is that we have a group of people who are fired up. They're excited. They're ready for activities. On the top of page 4, we have feastings and drunkenness with impurity and obscenity of the grossest kind. Then we have another one, feasts and drinking parties that are protracted till late at night and indulge in revelry. Often it's used for the god Bacchus, which is the god of drinking. But as I say, in 1 Peter 4:3, you see here on the middle, well, toward the top of page 4, in 1 Peter 4:3, drunkenness, revelry, drinking parties, Romans 13:13, not in revelry and drunkenness, and Galatians 5:21, drunkenness, revelries, and the like. So this is an activity that is involved with alcohol, but doesn't necessarily rise to the level of drunkenness or even intoxication. I think you remember when we did a sermon on this a few years ago that the government has determined that even before the motor skills are affected, the inhibitions are affected. So they've kind of changed the law. There's driving under the influence, and then there's driving while intoxicated, and there's a little bit of a difference there as far as the level of alcohol. And so, as I say, when people bring alcohol, it's for the purpose of lowering inhibitions and increasing the possibilities of having a good time. And of course, all the alcohol commercials, that's where they take us. They take us to revelry. They take us to people that are having a good time. And as I say, it may never reach drunkenness, but the point I think that he's making here is that when we attend a place that has alcohol with the realization that it could lead into these activities, the Christian doesn't need to be there. And so that I think really is the point. Let me read part of this paragraph, then I'll see if there's any comments. This is on the top of page 4, just under those three verses. It says, "The definitions bounce back and forth between alcohol and no alcohol. The fun-loving, loud, boisterous, and all this, all often foolish and sinful activities when people become too emotional. Those who become so relaxed and whose inhibitions have been lowered to a degree where they can and do make a fool of themselves. But it doesn't have to have alcohol. Loud music can do it. Sports events can do it. Dancing can do it. Banqueting can do it. So we just don't want to be in places like that. We don't want to be in places where worldly people are doing what worldly people are doing, because once we get into that kind of an activity, then 1 Corinthians 15 kicks in, which is evil companionship corrupts good morals. So, as I say, we start with drunkenness as a state, then we move to the process by which we become drunk, then we move to the places where alcohol may or may not be, but Christians don't need to be there. They don't need to be in a place where these kind of activities are going on. Whether or not drunkenness ever occurs isn't the point. So this idea that some Christians have that it's okay to drink as long as you don't get drunk, Peter is saying, no, it's not. No, it's not. There's certain activities where Christians have no business and no place. They shouldn't be there. Anybody have any other thoughts on that word?
Yeah, Alan, this is Charles. You know, a lot of the times when people say, you know, you want to be a responsible drinker, they're saying, you know, you can drink, but you want to be responsible for your actions and things. But everybody is not that way. Because there are a lot of people who drink and they don't know about being responsible for anything. And a Christian really shouldn't be, like you say, in situations like that. Whenever there's a funeral, if there's a wedding, something, and a Christian is invited to it, you have to make a decision. You know, as soon as whatever it is, if it's something, a close relative or whatever the case may be, a lot of times you have to move on because you know what's coming up next. And somebody said, okay, well, everybody here is drinking responsible, but a lot of time it's not the way it is. So you have to use good discretion behind it.
Well, that's a good point, Charles, and I agree with that. I think that if alcohol is there, I don't want to be there. Whether it's a funeral and a wake, whether it's a wedding and a reception, whether it's a party, worldly, you know, a party where people are gathering. There's just a point where the Christian says, I'm going to excuse myself. I mean, even if you go and you think, well, maybe it won't be that bad. As soon as you see what's going on, it's time to get out of there. Even if it's a business party, doesn't matter. This word really is pretty comprehensive regarding that particular activity. Anybody else have anything? Okay, well, the last one is on page 4, and it just means drinking. It's the only place it's used in the New Testament is here, but it describes a place where you can drink, and has nothing to do with alcohol. Has nothing to do with drunkenness. It has to do with the possibility. Trent said this: not of necessity excessive, but giving the opportunity for excess. So if you go to the bar, the opportunity is there. You don't have to drink excessively, but the opportunity for excess is there. So Christians shouldn't go to a bar. There's a lot of parties where, like I say, there's just a lot of alcohol there. And so any place where there is an opportunity to drink too much alcohol, Christians don't need to be there. And so this isn't just a situation where as long as there's no drunkenness involved, it's okay. That's Peter's taking us back. The Holy Spirit's taking us back here. If there's alcohol there, if there's drinking there, if it's going to lead to drunkenness, then that's the point where the Christian has to be alarmed. As I say, in 1 Peter 5, Peter's going to go on to say, be sober, be watchful. The adversary, the devil, is like a roaring lion. Well, alcohol dulls the senses and leaves us open. You know, you look at what happened to Lot. You look at what happened to Noah. You look at what happened to different individuals, the descriptions in Proverbs about the woe and the complaining and the sorrow that comes from alcohol. The statistics are just dismal. Alcohol is responsible for half the deaths, half the adulteries, half the divorces, half of this and half of that. I mean, it just increases the likelihood of misery by so much. And so Christians, you know, the last thing I want to be is one of these people that the alcohol company can point to and say, see, Alan can drink responsibly. Christians can drink responsibly. Therefore, there's nothing wrong with alcohol. I'm not going to give them that. Yeah, Christians have a lot more self-control, but alcohol is so dangerous that Christians don't need to touch it, and they certainly don't need to have any influence that would lead people in that direction, cause people to stumble. All right, before we move away from this concept of these 3 points of alcohol use, does anybody else want to weigh in or say anything about it or ask a question?
Yeah, I want to say that when you say you're a Christian, and let's say you're at a job and they say, we're going to meet over here, I don't know, John Smith's Bar and Grill down the street. And you go down there and you realize people are drinking. The problem is you're a Christian and you don't want to go there. For one thing, you don't want to be with yoked with unbelievers, right? You don't want to be with people doing those kind of things. And you don't want to have to walk in the door, like let's say you go get some gas and all of a sudden you walk in the wrong door and another person, you know, like you, see me walk into the wrong place and it happens to be a liquor store and I'm not going there to buy anything, but it looks like I'm going to buy something. So you don't want to even go down that road. You don't want to have yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time, no matter what, because you're going to be a bad influence to others. So you just don't want to be yoked with anyone involved in the worldly way. So you want to stay away from that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And better to be cautious. You know, we've all gotten caught before. We were told it was just going to be this particular activity. You get there, you assess what's going on, and you say, hey, I'm sorry, I got other things I got to do, and get out of there because of the very thing you're talking about. And like I say, it's once you're there, and there's temptations that we don't need. We just don't need to have a part of that. All right. Anybody else? Thanks, Ray. Okay, abominable idolatries is, I told Jeannie after I finished this section today, I just felt like getting sick. It was just thinking about all of the things. And so I'm not going to go into total detail on all the things that this is involved in, but the term abominable, you know, its basic meaning is it is opposed to custom, opposed to what decent, morally upright people would view as being acceptable. But the interesting thing here is just as the nations created their God, see, human Christians, we have a God who has told us how to worship. Well, how do the Gentiles figure out it? And of course, the bottom of page 5 here, depending on the character of the people, their gods are going to approve what they like, their wicked and evil propensity. So if you have a cruel, savage, and brutal group of people, then their God is going to allow them to practice the most despicable things. You know, you read about the Mayans who would cut open the chest of someone, cut out their heart while they're still alive, and then offer that beating heart to their God as a sacrifice. And you think, what an abominable thing to do. What a terrible, terrible thing. And yet these people, they would take their captives, they would take innocent victims, and that's what they would do. And you think, how in the world could somebody come up with that kind of a practice and worship their God like that? But that's what they did. And throughout the scriptures, got a lot of scriptures here on page 6. In Deuteronomy 12, it says, take heed to yourselves that you are not ensnared to follow these gods. Do not say, how did these nations serve their gods? I will do likewise. And God warned them, but they didn't listen. Well, what were some of these abominations? Well, in Deuteronomy 18, right in the middle of page 6, we have the abominations of the nations, making your son or daughter pass through the fire. Now, here's another practice, an idolatrous practice. You think, how in the world somebody come up with that? They created an idol that you could build a fire inside of it. Then you put arms on it and a big open mouth on it, and you have it configured in such a way so that whatever you put into the hands will roll down inside. Then you build a bonfire in there, and you put your children into the arms of this idol and roll it down into the fire so they can be killed. And you think, who in the world, what kind of people would do something like that? That's an abomination, and yet that's what they did. Now, we've sanitized it with abortion, but it's the same basic situation. When you have sexual immorality, you have children nobody wants. And if you have children nobody wants, then the best thing to do is come up with a way to get rid of the children. Well, the best way to get rid of the children is to put them to death. So let's create an idol that puts children to death. Then we'll create another idol that allows sexual immorality, and we'll put these two together. And that, if that's a propensity of the culture, and of course we've seen this. We've seen this since 1972 here in America, where after the sexual revolution in the 60s that was creating children nobody wanted, suddenly the Supreme Court found that the Constitution would allow us to kill these children. And so from 1972 until now, 1 million children every year, 1 million infants are aborted or killed, which if you add that up, we're about 50 million. The whole world's putting out 50 million a year. So there's another abominable practice. Then we have the bottom of page 6 is different kinds of sexual perversions. And he lists them here in Leviticus 18. Don't lie with a male as with a woman. No woman should stand up before an animal to mate with it. No man should mate with an animal, you're thinking. And then God says, it's perversion. And, you know, you don't have to tell Christians that. These are abominable idolatries. Then in the rest of chapter 18, he reveals every type of family relationship: mothers, fathers, daughters, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, mother-in-laws, father-in-laws. And then God says, do not have sexual activity with these people. But he also adds the land of Egypt where you dwelt and the land of Canaan where you're going. They did all these things. So the sexual practices of people who have a proclivity towards sexual immorality ultimately leads to homosexuality, bestiality, and incest. And we've seen so many changes here in our country, and we see it in other countries, that I just suspect that we'll be seeing some of these other things before very long. All right, I think that's enough. Anybody have any other thoughts on that before we move up to something a little more or a little less disgusting?
Please bring it.
I'm sorry?
Please bring the less disgusting stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, I will. But, you know, God sanitized it, too. I mean, like Paul said, the things they do in secret are a shame to speak of. And God doesn't really go into detail. But sometimes he does. Hosea 4, you can look at this later. I'm not going to read it right now. But on the middle of page 7, he talks about the fact that the sexual practices in the time of Hosea were so bad that God just was just disgusted with the things that they were doing. Okay, then, middle of page 7, in regard to these, they think it's strange that you don't run with them. And this, of course, is one of the main reasons why we have persecution. The Gentiles are fully engaged in these things, and they think it's very strange. I've got a chart on the middle of page 7 where the heading is the will of the Gentiles. And then they think it's strange that you're not in the midst of these things with them. So if you're not involved with lewdness and lust and drunkenness and revelries and drinking parties and abominable idolatries, they think you're strange. And I think we're reaching that level here in America where the people who are engaging in these things are now looking. It used to be the other way around. It used to be that the good people looked at it, at the wicked, and thought, this is very strange. But we're reaching a tipping point or an inversion point where there are more people involved in the sinful activities than there are people who are involved in doing what God would have revealed them to do. And so now we're kind of back where, in America anyway, I think maybe in other cultures they've never gotten there, but we used to have a fairly upright, worldly group of people. In other words, they didn't reach these abomination levels. They were wicked, but they didn't reach that level. But now they think it's strange that we won't jump into the water with them. They think it's strange. They invite us to come. If we don't come, they think it's strange. They think that there's something odd or unusual about us. And so the idea of strange is just something that's very odd, very unusual. It's surprising. It's astonishing. Why would somebody act like that? And so the Gentiles are astonished that we wouldn't commit fornication. The Gentiles are astonished that we won't get drunk. The Gentiles are astonished that we won't get involved in their abominable idolatries and their activities. And so they have certain expectations. And of course, as I said earlier, this is what leads us into persecution, because first they think it's strange, then they see it as an indictment. You know, the reason we don't do it is because we think it's wrong. Well, if you think it's wrong, then that's pretty strange, but the strangeness is you, not us. And so they expect us to, they expect Christians, they expect everyone to conform to whatever they think is the right way to do things. And if people point out that it's not, they think that's strange. All right, before we move on to the next point, anybody have anything they want to add or any practical applications they want to make? Okay, the definition of run together is kind of interesting. Not so much the definition, but the other two uses in the scriptures. This is the word on the middle of page 8. This is the word that when the multitudes see Jesus, they knew him and ran there on foot from all the cities. And when Peter and John healed the lame man, all the people ran together to them. In other words, there's an excitement here. There's an anticipation here. And there's some powerful emotions. And when the Gentiles devise a new and novel way to indulge in lusts, they've got that same excitement. They're just so excited. They can't wait to share with people the latest foray into sinful activities that they've just found out. And it's just amazing to hear people brag about and share these things. And sometimes, because they don't know who we are, they want to share that with us. And they want us to be as excited, and they want us to run into the same activities that they're involved in. And when we don't, they think that's really, really strange. There's something wrong with you. Why would you be like that? And then the description of this activity, he now introduces a couple of more concepts. The first one is flood. And of course, what happens with a flood is people drown. Paul talked about that in 1 Timothy 6 when he said, those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts that drown men in destruction and perdition. So it's not just the love of money, it's the love of any sinful excess. That's the thing about sin. Whatever our, again, our propensities, what are the things that we are drawn to? And every one of us is different. Some of us look at people who have any sexual interest as being very strange. And then others who are involved in these sexual excesses look at the people who aren't and think they're very strange. And so it's interesting how people create their own normal. And the alcoholic has his normal, and the adulterer or the fornicator or the homosexual or the person who has sex with animals, they have their normal. And they think it's strange that other people don't see things the way that they do. And they're shocked when we're not interested in this new thing that they've found and our participation in it. And so, again, Peter is just really hammering on this and expressing it so that we'll have a pretty clear picture of exactly what it is that we shouldn't be involved in. All right, anybody have any points on that or thoughts? Okay, on the top of page 9, we have a word that doesn't have a lot of meaning in English. It's the word riot. Passage where Paul talks about the qualifications of elders, he says that the children should not be accused of riot. And, you know, we have riots today, but they don't have anything really in common with this particular word. And it's a pretty comprehensive word. I got ahead, like I say, I got half a page here on the definition of it from Trench. It's interesting that as far as Trench is concerned, the first word we started with, which is that lasciviousness, and the last word that we're ending with, which is riot, he says that they're synonyms. Matter of fact, the first thing he says is, it is very unlikely that he who is, and I won't bother the Greek words, but he who is involved in riot will not also be involved in lasciviousness. But they're not identical in meaning. And then he says they express different aspects of sin. And then he goes in and he talks some things, and he talks about how primarily the word means somebody who can't control what they want to spend. They're a spendthrift. Word he used, because he lived a long time ago, was a scatterling. In other words, somebody who just scatters everything that they have. And so this is a person who spends too much, who spends his expenditures on a more magnificent scale than he has the means to do. But then it didn't stop there. This is where the word takes its leap, or this is where the word takes its importance, because as he goes on to say that if we will spend our money, then ultimately we will spend ourselves. And so he goes on into spending on our own lusts and appetites, to which so freely does he engage in them that it just reaches a point where it's too expensive. Because it's too expensive, he starts to destroy himself. So this is the alcoholic who has reached a point where alcohol has just completely begun to destroy him. That's how... this is what riot is. And in the sexual realm, this would be where the prostitute starts, where somebody has reached a level where they're using their body in that way. And just, again, it just takes on, as he says, it takes a new color and indicates now not only one who has sensual desires, but one who is dissolute and debauched. And It's like the prodigal. Matter of fact, the prodigal is a perfect example of riot. Matter of fact, I think it's called riotous living. He wasted his goods on prostitutes, but then he wasted himself. He went out and he started having to eat the you know, taking care of pigs, which to the Jew would be the bottom of the barrel, and then eating the food that was for the pigs. I mean, he reached a point where, and that's what sin does. So riot means that the sin has become the master. And then his last point on there is the fundamental notion of riot is wastefulness and excess and lasciviousness of lawless insolence. In other words, I don't care whether you like what I'm doing or not. So they're shocked when we won't waste our body and our soul and our emotions like they do. But we see something that they don't see. We see the waste. We see the prodigal living. We see the damage that it can do. And we don't want to have any part of it. But because we won't go where they go, they speak evil of us. All right. Anybody want to weigh in on rioting or riotous living? And Peter dealt with it. He's going to deal with this again in the second Peter letter when he says that when a man is overcome, he is placed under the bondage of that lust. So every sin, again, reaches a tipping point where we are no longer the master enjoying the sin, but the sin has become the master, and we don't even enjoy it anymore, but we have been completely overcome, and we can't stop. And that's where a lot of people are. That's where people take their own lives. That's where people start to lose their mind. I mean, mental illness and suicide is all based on people who have just reached a point where what they do makes them sick, but they can't stop. Because of that, it just creates so much grief and so much sorrow in the world. And of course, God is a loving God, and He has taught His children to be loving and to rise above these things and to try to help others rise above them, which means we can't get involved in these activities. But instead of thanking us and seeing us as the salt and the light, as seeing us as an uplifting influence, they speak evil. And that's the next word here, and it's the Greek word blasphemy, which is kind of interesting. Whenever it's spoken about God, we just transliterate the word, like baptism is the Greek word baptizo, and blasphemy is the Greek word blasphemeo. And so when it's of God, we just use the word. But in the Greek language, they use the word for God and man. But when they use man, they changed it to speak reproachfully, revile, or speak evil of. And so one person, one lexicon had blasphemy is abusive speech, and euphemia would be like a euphemism. A euphemism is finding a nice way to say something that's thoroughly disgusting. So we look for ways to say something nice. I remember I was in Yosemite one time, and a bear had come in and taken our food. We saw a ranger, and he said, well, they pulled it out of the valley and they put it up here. I said, well, what do they do next? He said, well, we euthanize them. Well, euthanize means we kill them. So they have nice ways of saying things, and they have blasphemous ways of saying. So they're not going to speak well. They're not going to speak good. The word Christian doesn't have or won't have a connotation of something that's good, but unfortunately it's something that's evil. And again, I think we're seeing an inversion here. We're starting to see how things could quickly go in that direction. But that's, again, this is the first step in persecution. First, they think it's strange that we don't go with them. Then they start speaking evil of us. And then they begin to do the active persecution, where not only are they speaking evil, but now they are doing evil toward people. And so that's where Peter is trying to help us understand that sometimes the persecution is going to come just because you want to do what's right and you don't want to keep doing what you were doing. I remember losing all my friends very, very quickly after I became a Christian because I started preaching against all the things they were doing, and they didn't want to hear it. So it never got violent, but they didn't want me around anymore because of found situations like that. Anybody want to weigh in on this idea of speaking evil of Christians and looking down on them and thinking they're very strange? Okay, in verse 5, which is on the top of page 10, we get some perspective. I mean, up to this point in the chapter, we've been here on earth, looking at things from an earthly perspective. The Gentiles are doing this. This is how they see things. The Christians are doing this. This is how they see things. Now in verse 5, we bring God back into the mix. We bring God back into the equation. And so Peter says they will give an account to him. Now, this is why we don't want to be involved in this. Matter of fact, Paul said in Acts chapter 17, the times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. He's appointed a day in which he will judge the world. He's given assurance to this to all men by raising him from the dead. Well, this was Paul's preaching. This was Paul's sermon to the people in Athens. They thought it was strange. Matter of fact, they didn't want to hear anymore after that. But Paul was expressing the truth. Everyone is going to give an account. And the word give is the idea of giving back what was given to us. And in this case, we're going to give back an account. But the giving back of the account is essentially the explanation of, here's what you gave me, God. You gave me a mind, you gave me a body, you gave me a soul, you gave me emotions, you gave me opportunities. Here's what I did with them. And then God will say, well, here's what I'm going to do with you because these are the things that you did. But it's interesting that every one of us is going to have our say. Every one of us is going to have an opportunity to explain to God, here's what I did and here's why I did it. And then God will render the judgment. And it's kind of interesting. Jesus talks about how the Queen of the South is going to rise up against his generation and condemn them. And you're thinking, wow, is there going to be interaction here? One nation, he says that the people of Sodom and Gomorrah are going to rise up and condemn Bethsaida because if the works had been done in Sodom that were done here, they would have repented. And so they're going to be there to condemn you. And it just sounds like the judgment day is going to be a fearful and an awful set of circumstances in which no one is going to really be able to justify their wicked conduct. But they are going to give an account. They are going to give an account. In Revelation, it says that the books are going to be open and we're going to be judged out of those books. So everything we've done is being written down. The words are being written down. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 11, by your words you'll be justified, by their words you'll be condemned. So our words are being written down. Our thoughts are being written down. Actions are being written down. And unless we repent and become a Christian, that's going to stand. And on the judgment day, we're going to have to go before God and we're going to have to explain why we did all of them. Whereas a Christian is going to be forgiven, and so he's not going to have to explain any of those things. It's not going to be there. There isn't going to be any book that we have to deal with except the Lamb's Book of Life, if we stay faithful. But again, if there's any sins on there, we're going to have to give an account for that. And so it isn't just the Gentiles. It's everyone. Matter of fact, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 10, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he has done, whether good or bad. Knowing therefore the terror of the Lord, we persuade men. So this is, God is again helping us to understand that don't take these things to heart. I'm going to take care of it all. They are going to give an account to me. Even though they're blaspheming you, even though they're persecuting you, even though they're tempting you and expecting you to get involved in their activities, I'll take care of that. You just need to do what's right, because God is going to judge both the living and the dead. So that there isn't going to be any difference. God is ready. The word ready means that he's prepared. Matthew 25:34, inherit the kingdom prepared from the foundation of the world. Matthew 25:41, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. God is completely prepared now. That's why we're in the last days. There's nothing else. God is prepared to judge the world. There's nothing waiting. There's nothing in between. We're just waiting for God to say, this is the time. The time has come. The end is here. We're going to finish this. Hasn't made that decision yet. Whether we're getting closer or further away, who knows? God's in control of that. But we know that we're only one heartbeat away from him saying, it's done. And the end is here. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15:24, when the end comes, then everything's going to be delivered back to God, and the judgment day is going to occur, and all these things are going to happen. But God's prepared right now. Everything's set. There's nothing else that needs to be done. He is ready to pass judgment and bring about condemnation, and being dead or alive isn't going to change anything. Change anything at all. Anybody have any questions, comments, thoughts on any of this? Everybody's pretty quiet tonight.
Yep. I'm sitting here being very quiet, except for right now.
Well, I don't mind. I mean, but if anybody has any comments, they can jump in.
Just a really good fear of the Lord thing you were just speaking.
Well, as I say, you know, some classes are uplifting and enjoyable. This one's, you know, I mean, it's just we're down at the very bottom of the barrel here. So I can see where, you know, I won't say it's discouraging, but it's an enlightening class.
Alan?
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to take and have comments just a little bit ago, but couldn't get our machine to work right here.
Okay.
when you're talking about like at Corinth and some places like that we read in the scriptures how corrupt it was, there's people out there that have done a lot of studies about this kind of stuff, and some of them Christians, and I think some of the things that they've written is right on target. We've gone through now probably at least 3, maybe 4 generations, more than that probably, of young people that have been raised up in homes that does not have the moral values of what us older people experienced when we grew up. So these people come along and migrate into society. We wonder, well, how in the world is it that they could take and do those kind of things, think that way, and not bother them at all? And I think one of the simpler ways to look at it is, well, what kind of training have they had as far as moral values are concerned? Because they're taught that, like, homosexuality is just another lifestyle. It doesn't make any difference whether you marry a man or a woman. Two men can get married because it's their love of life. You know, our society is getting so corrupt and so polluted with this kind of stuff. It's awfully hard to find an electorate out there. By that, what I mean by that is a vast number of people that are thinking very clearly about these things, because they're not. Our nation is not right now thinking clearly about the moral structure that we've woven into our society. And it's not going to get any better.
No. We're watching the dissolution of morals and basic fabric that held our country together all these years, and we're seeing it unravel and fray. It's just so...
Well, it used to be, and you know, I realize I hate to even use the term, it used to be, because a lot of times, and we've all heard it as older people, oh yeah, you know, you're just as old as dirt, you know. But it's just the way life is. Yeah, there's some things that we learned a long time ago that you just don't do. And we have an awful lot of young people now. They don't think a thing in the world about doing it. It's just part of the lifestyle. It don't make any difference. And where did they come from? Nobody has slapped their hands this way, so to speak, and said, you can't do that. It's not good. It's not right. It's wrong. Anyway.
Nope. You're hitting on it, Virgil. We used to read about what happened in Corinth and say, well, that could never happen here. And overnight, it's happening here, and you're going, wow, what happened? How did this happen?
Yes, it has. And, you know, to me, it's kind of refreshing sometimes to sit down with some of the, even some younger people who have their heads screwed on right, yeah, and talk with them about these things and find that there is some people out there, and young people too, that realize that the lifestyle and what's happening in our country is not good. It is not good at all. And it's just leading more and more our school systems. We hear a lot of times of teachers being fired because they would use the words like homosexuality is a sin. They're out the door, their history. And, you know, that should not be. That should not be at all. We had a lot of, and I went to a public school. We didn't have homeschool in the area that I grew up. But we did have prayer in school, and we used to sing religious songs in school. And the teachers were not afraid to take and teach, especially the book of Genesis, the creation. And there was nobody held that over their head and said, you can't do that. But things, you know, is just changed around an awful lot. So what do we expect out of our young people? Well, what they're being taught, that's what they're practicing out now.
It's heartbreaking. But
yeah, it is.
Paul went to Corinth and preached to them and saved some people, so it's all is not lost.
Yeah. Yeah, Martha was just pointing out to me that one of the verses here on page one that you had in there, Jeremiah 6, verses 13 through 16. But the highlighted one is verse 15, were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? No, they were not at all ashamed, nor did they know how to blush. That comes from training early on.
Yeah. Yep. The world has shifted so drastically.
Yeah. But, you know, I appreciate you bringing these things up, Ellen, the teaching on this. And Christians nowadays, we need to be able to speak out against these things. There's a way to do it without being thrown out, at least initially. But, you know, you can't go in there with an axe and start trimming things out. That's not our job. We need to go in there with the word and take it, try to convince people, and let it do its job.
Amen. No, that's exactly right. That's right. Okay, well, it's 8:30, so we'll go ahead and we'll stop here for tonight.
And again, I talked too long. I'm sorry.
No, Virgil, you didn't. That's all right.
That was great. Thank you.
It'll only take me a few seconds to finish this up next week, verse 6. So there's just very, very little there. So don't worry about that. I prefer you guys to comment and express yourself. So, all right. Anybody else?
I have one comment about the lasciviousness, drinking, and et cetera. And that is, from what I have seen over my lifetime and what some doctors and others have said, most people get drunk after one drink, and they don't do what they normally would do. So we as Christians in particular need to keep that in mind, that one drink at best would lose cause most people to lose some inhibitions, and then that leads to sin and things that no one should do.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%, 110%. It's just so sad to see people, Christians, arguing, well, I can drink, I can have drinks, I just won't get drunk. Well, that's not possible. And you make a good point, George, and all the drinking tables now prove that one drink is enough to make some people legally drunk, but it's definitely enough to make them drunk as far as God would see. So that's a good point. All right, George, you want to lead us in our closing prayer tonight, please?